Peggy, now we're going to move on to Robbie Rockery, who's going to be looking at renewing faith in community finance. Oh, yeah, that's my job.
Right, so good afternoon, everyone. First thing that I'm going to say is that this has been presented a couple of times to theologians. It's not been presented to economists yet, so my apology. I think I've managed to shear off the basic economics, which you will all understand, and concentrate perhaps actually more on, well, actually more on theological issues, which is perhaps appropriate for this context. So, let me just... Yes, here we are. More than 10 years ago, a group of finance professionals based in Scotland convened the rather grandly named Global Ethical Finance Initiative. And one of their first initiatives was to draft what became known as the Edinburgh Finance Declaration. Over 3 years, there was consultation with finance professionals and mostly Christian and Muslim theologians. This, by the way, is a picture taken down on House. Just for the final declaration being drafted. And it incorporated the world's first shared values framework for financial investment. So what I'm going to try to do today is to present the declaration, firstly, as a response to well-understood concerns about the future of financial markets. But I'm also going to argue that despite the association with Edinburgh and the Church of Scotland being an important sponsor, the moderator and the Minister of Greyfriars Kirk in Edinburgh are both in that picture. At the time, he was head of the Church and Society Council of the Church of Scotland. Despite the Church's involvement in it, it has had very little effect on the Church's activities. That partly reflects the shrinkage of capacity of our national Church in Scotland. And so I'm going to suggest that one way in which the Church, one way in which Scottish society could start to implement ideas from this particular declaration would be through improving the use of community finance institutions. Now, if I was telling this story to theologians, I would spend a lot of time talking about the nature of the global financial crisis and the range of responses to it. We've already heard, actually, in some discussions today, we've heard some of that already. To some finance professionals, the people that decided to put together the Global Ethical Finance Initiative, it seemed that the entire financial system had become very self-absorbed in the years leading up to the financial crisis. And so they began to think about ways in which they could shift the focus of the financial system away from the short term, and what they saw as the extraction of profit from the use of resources, back towards the long term and the development of sustainable new resources. Thinking really about what the purpose of finance should be. And it so happens that this began in Scotland with the realization amongst some young Muslim finance professionals that many faith traditions had a rich and often shared history of arguing about what constitutes legitimate activity in financial markets. Again, there's much more I could say here. Some of them relate back to work that I did with Jubilee 2000. But from the when I first became involved with this group, one of the things that she picked up was the fact that, well, Sharia law prevented the certification of derivative instruments as being Sharia compliant. And that meant that Muslim financial institutions had done relatively well during the financial crisis. So what was happening was in 2011, 2012, there were all sorts of salespeople, marketing people within financial institutions who were advocating for Islamic funds because they were more stable, they were more secure, they would offer more certain returns. That wasn't the story. It was just, I would have to say, in many ways, but I will do a little bit more here. I will say, I'll just give a very brief story about what happened and how the story reached here. By the way, very interesting possibility. Why is London the centre for so many global financial markets? Because common law appears to have derived many of its principles from Islamic law. And there's a really interesting story to be told about how that went from Sicily to Aquitaine and then into English law and Henry II. But I want to talk about scholastic theologians taking over arguments from Muslim theologians, developing property rights being necessary for the specific use of resources. Now, in this tradition, what do we mean by, and this perhaps has to answer some of Paul's questions or address some of Paul's questions, what would we mean by a Christian interpretation of property rights? And the answer is that they should be contingent on enabling productive use of resources for the benefit of society. That was Christian orthodoxy for about 500 years. And there's a whole lot of things that I could argue about this. For example, anyone whose use of property imposes burdens on others could reasonably be prevented from doing so. And harm principle is, of course, a fundamental part of the economic analysis of law, but it's also important in ethical analysis. So the concept of property was the starting point for the Edinburgh Finance Declaration. And key to the Edinburgh Finance Declaration is the concept of stewardship. This places investors in the position of being an agent, acting on behalf of some principle, and ultimately, as Christian investors, acting on behalf of God. So, arguing that we're all stewards in the created order, of which we are all ourselves part, we believe that humans are at the apex of the created order, that we have been granted dominion over creation, but that gives us no license to exploit it. In pursuing our own well-being, we have to remain mindful of the well-being of creation. And then, once you've got that understanding of stewardship, the other principles within the Edinburgh Finance Declaration seem to follow quite naturally by adding in principles of justice, and which I'm simply going to define here as giving to others what is their right or their due. I know that's unsatisfactory, but I'm going to skip over. That's a particular point. And turn to the fact that when we consider other people, including those who are harmed by the operation of the financial system without being active participants in it, or when we consider the creation itself, these, by the way, are arguments which start to get us into our thinking about climate justice, perhaps, and we should be thinking about primarily restorative concepts, which so we would recognise and, where possible, reverse the harm caused by our actions. We should be able to anticipate future harms and choose alternatives to diminish them. Now, that in itself might seem to be enough for a faith-influenced financial system. We would place stewardship and justice at the heart of it, and the other principles which are in the Edinburgh Finance Declaration, supporting human flourishing, the common good, sustainability, and even love of our neighbours, would offer guidance to shape their application. I'm going to place just one slight qualification here. The boundary between the practice of justice and of love can, I think, be quite difficult to define. An expansive definition of justice could certainly be a warrant for a course of action based on what others are due, defined very broadly. Again, we've talked about some of that already today. Love, however, does not have an association with duty, but is much more deeply relational, suggesting a unilateral concern for the well-being of another part of the created order, which in turn is motivated without expectation of benefit or gain. In other words, I'm going to make what might seem a surprisingly Beckerian move in this argument. I'm going to claim that love is stewardship applied to persons, and so does not need to draw on the requirements of either justice or law. Now, in that case, the motivation for acting justly is the recognition of the object having inalienable rights, as Adam has already suggested in terms of hospitality. The motivation for acting lovingly seems to be the recognition of the value of the other as a part of creation. And so the other deserves the development of its potential. Justice, an outcome of reason, love, a visceral response, emotional response to the needs and potential of others. So again, justice and love, this is perhaps back to what AJ was talking about at the beginning of this session. So if I look at the Edinburgh Finance Declaration, these great guiding principles allow us to think about pro-social behaviour. And what happened was that people started to think almost entirely in terms of international development and global finance for climate change. In this last short section, I want to sketch out other possibilities consistent with these principles. And I'm going to just talk about the embraced systematic biases and decision-making towards the development so that we can think about how more resilient communities might emerge. This is in some ways thinking about the role of institutions and how institutions can emerge. I'd like to anchor what has been done by comparing the situation in the United States, that in Great Britain. I am aware that Northern Ireland is separate from this here because Ireland, for these purposes, is one island. And so in the United States, the federal government has been concerned for many years that there are communities in which there is only limited access to financial services. This goes back to the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act, which got rid of redlining, the practice of drawing a red line on a map and within the area granting no credit. It was demonstrated to be clearly discriminatory on racial grounds. Introducing a requirement that banks demonstrate that they can provide fair access to the whole of their customer base, the legislation drove many changes in practice, including subprime lending. So just because something is done for good reasons, it doesn't have to have good outcomes. Of more relevance to what I'm suggesting, by requiring banks to reinvest in areas where they closed branches, the legislation anticipated the risk of rebanking, where closure programs mean that communities lose access to services. So what happened over time was that American banks found many ways of working with community development organizations to provide patient capital allowing their development. And over 50 years, legislative and regulatory obligations have supported the emergence of a wide variety of financial institutions with a community development mission. Now, these institutions tend to be smaller in scale than many banks. They tend to have ownership structures in which there is less pressure to provide investors with financial returns, and those features have enabled the best of these organizations to have substantial social impact. In 1994, the federal government then instigated the Community Development Finance Initiative. It has effectively been bound up in the last 6 months. But for 30 years, the US Treasury provided a steadily increasing flow of capital organizations to certified community development finance institutions. Certification was official recognition of these institutions' ability to participate in support of disadvantaged communities, but certification would only allow half of the funding or would only release matched funding. The institutions had to go to private organizations in order to raise the other half of the capital which they were using. The total flow by 2024 reached $500 million, and that was regularly increasing flow of funding to these communities by about $10 billion a year. It had a substantial effect. And perhaps the easiest way for this to translate into British practice, over the last 15 years particularly, the bulk of this funding went to community development credit unions. Now, credit unions, I'm going to assume, I know there are some Americans, some Canadians, some Irish people here, you may know that they're cooperatives, you may know that the simplest form of credit union involves members amassing a pool of savings from which each can apply for loans. That is very much what they are in Great Britain. But in the United States, credit unions are community-owned banks. They offer a full range of financial services to personal customers and indeed to small business customers. By sharing of processing and other activities, even small American, locally based credit unions can offer services such as current accounts and credit cards. Both of those types of service diversify and stabilize their income, making the organizations much more sustainable. And they are community-centered businesses and community organizations which are answerable to their members, who are the people living in the community. Now, it may well be that there is no easy way of making British credit unions like their American counterparts. There has been 30 years at least of attempts by the British government to get credit unions to take on a larger scale of activity, and none of them have worked so far. So I'm going to end with some questions rather than providing answers. My first question, what might be done in Britain with its very different traditions and history of organising financial services? much of the American legislation came out of the civil rights movement. We didn't have slavery in Britain, and so we didn't have that heritage to respond against. Secondly, given that there should be a pre-existing association amongst the members of credit unions so that people can join them, how might credit unions engage types of virtual communities which are increasingly important to people? And lastly, and this is a question which, again, when I'm talking to theologians, to financiers, and also to faith groups, what part might churches and their many resources play in supporting the development of credit union capabilities? Thank you very much.
Sure, we've maybe one or two questions. Anything online first? Put your hand up. Any question here? Yeah, Andy?
Picking up on the second point, so third one. You threw in the online issue at the end, and I wonder whether the extent to which online community is replacing physical community because of the preference that people might have to go to places like Kickstarter and all the other sites. And so actually, one is almost replacing the other, potentially increasing the amount of relational distance left between one another. I don't know enough about it. The second about what churches might do, I think, is more challenging. It's challenging for churches. Reflecting on this as a trustee,